Good morning. The court calls United States v. Capel.
May it please the court, I'm Major Matthew King, representing Airman Chadrick Capel. Chief Judge Baker, I request to reserve 3 minutes.
Granted.
Honorable Court, this court granted review of two issues, and I will focus on the second, that the document signed by Airman Capel in an off-duty status in a local police station on a Valdosta Police Department witness statement form for a local police detective conducting his own non-military investigation into an off-base identity theft was not official within the meaning of Article 107 of the UCMJ. Article 107 requires that the government prove not just that an accused signed a false document, it must prove that this was a false official document. The language provided—
Counsel, this is an inter-say case, and it happened on base. Isn't that enough to render it official?
This did not occur on the installation, Your Honor.
The computer wasn't on the installation?
This is the wallet.
Oh, this is the wallet. Okay.
Yeah. Yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
Sorry, wrong case. It's an inter-say case. It happened between two airmen?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Isn't that enough?
That is not enough, Your Honor.
Why not?
If you look at the nature of the relationship between those two airmen, yes, they were both airmen. However,
one absconded with the property of another.
Can I take you back one step holding that? But first, what is it you're trying to prove or disprove? You say the issue is whether it's official or not. Is that what you're focusing on?
Yes,
or are you focusing on whether it's military official?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether it is official.
I just want to know what the standard is before you start getting into whatever that means.
Is there a link to the military? Is it in the line of duty as the main?
Where does that come from, the link to the military? It says official. Must it be something that is military official?
Well, the manual for courts martial.
You'll get to your question. Yeah.
The manual for courts martial indicates in the line of duty. And granted, this court has
not in the line of duty as in a line of duty investigation.
Yes, Your Honor. It is broader than in the line of duty investigation.
Right.
In terms of that nature. What this court has looked at in the past, the two primary cases are United States versus Tafoe and United States versus Day, Day being the most recent. And in both of those cases, this court focused on the military links of either the speaker of the statements, primarily in the Tafoe case, or in the U.S. v. Day case.
And is that because the overall purpose of 107 is to prevent the undermining of the official function?
Yes, Your
Honor. Is
that
the theory? And then the question is, must the official function be a military function?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because that is how this court has interpreted throughout its jurisprudence. And perhaps it would be useful to give examples of the contrary, Your Honor. In dating all the way back to United States versus Arthur and United States versus Cummings, which is court cited in United States versus Day, those are instances where it was even military members involved. And in Cummings, for instance, there was an assault outside of an officer's, in Arthur, there was an assault outside of an officer's club. An officer stepped in. The person who committed the assault gave a false name to the officer. The Court of Military Appeals found in that case that was not official because it was not the official military duties of the person asking the question. In Day, for instance.
Okay, you've answered my question. You largely focus on case law then rather than some overriding legal policy or legal principle.
Your Honor, there is a legal principle at stake here, which was really accentuated in this court's ruling in U.S. versus Jackson. And the simple analogy there is if you lie to the FBI or the Secret Service, the appropriate statute to address that is 18 U.S. Code 1001. If you lie to military investigators, then Article 107 is appropriate. And in this case, because
go back to Judge Stuckey's question then, since I was just trying to set the framework before you filled it in. Remember, his question was, why isn't an E4, E5 offense, or E5, E4 offense?
Because, Your Honor, because this court has looked at a totality of the circumstances. Numerous factors go in. And to have just a per se rule that if there's two military members involved would be broader than what this court has interpreted as official. So simply having two military members doesn't automatically make it official.
Okay, going back to my confusion over the facts, he got what he needed out of the wallet. When he ordered the stuff on the computer, did that take place on base?
One instance took place.
Yeah, and the computer was owned by another member of the armed forces.
Yes,
yeah,
sir.
Staff Sergeant somebody or other. Okay.
Counsel,
go ahead.
No, finish.
No, so you've got an interse case, at least part of which occurred on base, and that's not enough?
No, Your Honor. In this case, because there was no military investigation. It doesn't mean it was...
Are you propounding a per se rule that when you talk to somebody who's not military, it's not an official statement?
No, Your Honor. That's
then that, what are you saying?
In an instance, for instance, in the Tufo case, those were civilian investigators. However, in that case, they were civilian investigators investigating a crime essentially with the military. The military was doing a similar investigation. Under those circumstances, that does make it an official statement to those civilian investigators. In this case, there's no indication that the military was doing its own investigation. OSI had not been involved. There's no indication OSI had or Security Forces Office of Investigations had even been notified. There was no military investigation ongoing.
Well, does it have to be investigation, or put another way, does the relationship to make it official have to be between the offense and the military, or between the circumstances under which the statement was made and the military? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, some of the factors that Judge Stuckey asked you about have to do with the offense, but has that been the focus of this court?
Your Honor, that was one of the factors considered by this court in the Tufo case. It was not really treated as a factor in the Day case. Appellant would argue that, or appellant does argue that, it should not be, what should be the focus of the court is the nature of the statement, the circumstances surrounding the statement, not the underlying facts that led to the statement.
What additional facts would change this from an unofficial statement to an official statement?
There is a point in the case where Sergeant Addison, whose card numbers were taken, he goes to his leadership. His shop chief and his first sergeant. They tell him, just go ahead and go downtown and file some kind of report with the Valdosta Police Department. If they had not done that, instead they had said, let's go to the Security Forces or the Security Forces Office Investigation, or if they had picked up a phone and called OSI, and Security Forces or OSI had initiated an investigation.
But that goes back to the earlier question, does it have to be a statement to a military investigation? So I'm asking you, change a factor where he's making a statement, change the facts of this case so that the statement is still being made to the civilian authorities, where you think it would change from being unofficial to official?
If the military was involved and they called Detective Renfro, that civilian detective, and said, hey, can you look into this? Tell us what you know, what you find out. If they had essentially adopted that civilian investigation and were going to adopt it as their own, planning on adopting it as their own, essentially, it doesn't have to rise necessarily to the level of agency, but that detective would essentially be doing the military's investigation. That would make it official.
What if the statement that he made was a lie, a false statement about some official duty on his part, but he made it to a civilian police officer?
That would also be a case where there would be a stronger case for that being an official statement. As this court noted in Day, there's really two ways to get to an official statement, either by the speaker or the maker of the statement, or by the listener, the hearer of the statement. And obviously, the terminology is a little different for a document, as in this case. In that case, Your Honor, if he was making a false statement or writing a false document about his military duties, that would put it into the area of where it involved in the line of duty potentially for the speaker. And that would be the approach to say that this was an official statement. But that's not what this was about. This case was about an off-base identity theft.
Yeah. Counsel, have you done any research into the genesis of 107?
I have, Your Honor.
Because under the Articles of War, the false statement was to prevent people like quartermasters from filing false claims and things of that nature, wasn't it?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And what case of ours? Was it the Prater case that analogized it to 18-1001?
I believe Prater did, but Solis did as well, Your Honor. And all those dealt with the exculpatory no doctrine, but certainly the history is relevant in that
but
regard.
But when the law talks about the official statement, I always assumed, and maybe obviously I'm wrong given the jurisprudence of this court, but I always assumed you had to have an official duty to make the statement, or the statement you were making was to an official who had the duty to gather the information, such as if you had in the Air Force, if you had an aircraft accident, you had one of those investigative boards, you had to tell them the truth, that type of thing. But we have now spread that to where if you tell a civilian policeman a lie, that's a false official statement? Is that where we're going?
Well, that is where the Air Force Court went, Your Honor. And that's obviously where I do not believe this court should go.
Why not? I think the chief judge asked what's the distinction between lying to an OSI agent and lying to the city detective. And as far as prejudice to good order and discipline, as far as corruption of morale, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Your Honor, part of the issue here is how Article 107 is drafted. It is not designed to capture all false statements made by military members. It's designed to capture false official statements. And obviously that term official and what that means is what the discussion today focuses on. But to your question about some of the prior jurisprudence and when is it official with regard to, is there a requirement for a duty? I will acknowledge that this court has come away from a strict reading to say there must be an absolutely set in stone law duty that you must talk to this person, and that's obviously how...
That was what the false identification of the officer, that was a distinction made in that case, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The case you cited where the person told the officer a false name was not a false official statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because he had no duty to give him a correct name.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's three possibilities. There's the speaker acting in the line of duty, the hearer acting in the line of duty and in a military capacity, and the hearer acting in a line of duty, and where the case law seems to be less clear than it might be, is the degree to which the hearer acting in a civilian line of duty but necessarily has a military nexus. Would you agree with that statement that Day and explores whether you can get to a point where there's a sufficient nexus, predictable nexus to a military function?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with that, by the way, or not, as a matter of law, before you tell me why you don't fit into that category?
Yes, Your Honor, we do agree that is a valid standard. Now, this court mentioned that in the footnote, so there is some debate as to how the
fourth category would be any statement to anybody acting in an official capacity, which is completely off base or off duty, IRS agent or something.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've said that you think that 1001 is the suitable offense there, but going back to the third category, which was civilian acting in an official capacity with a necessary and predictable nexus to a military function. First, do you agree that that is a correct interpretation of 107 or not?
I do, Your Honor, but it must be narrowly tailored, and that ties into how the facts bear out in this case. And I think that the Day case is a perfect example. of when we talk about a predictable nexus. In that case, you had a call to a 911 operator that was not considered an official statement. When he, Airman Day, was on Little Rock Air Force Base calling to have base officials sent to his home on base about an incident or crime that happened on that base, and that was still not official. So I think that demonstrates how narrow this predictable nexus is. And the government's brief, for instance, there's a lot of discussion of the broad reach of the Uniform Code of Military Justice being a determining factor for the military nexus. If that were the case, basically the exception would swallow the entire rule, because with Article 92, derelictions, Article 134, general offense, and if you throw in Article 133 for officers, essentially anything at that point would have potential UCMJ ramifications, any bad act committed by any military member. And that's not what I believe was intended with Article 107. As the history indicated, Your Honor pointed out, it goes back to the Articles of War, false muster and false returns, which weren't just officer cases. False returns was actually only for commanding officers. So yes, the legislative history does indicate that there was an expansion of those concepts in the modern Article 107, but it's a matter of context. It's not an expansion from...
So is the break point for you then when he goes to the victim goes to the command and the command refers him to civilian authorities?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you factually, if you look at that, there's no indication that was their mechanism to help him deal with that, to get the command involved. It was really them just saying, hey, this is a downtown problem, take it downtown. And that really goes to show that this is not a military issue. At that point, the route they chose, there was no military nexus.
I mean, the only nexus to the military is it involves military members. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. And I should note, they're not just supervisor subordinate, they're also good friends, as described by Sergeant Addison.
You're out of time. You have some reserved. Are there any questions up here? You have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the Honorable Court, may it please the Court. I'm Captain Brian Mason, along with Colonel Don Christensen, who represent the United States in this matter. Honorable members of the Court, appellant's false statement regarding his crimes of stealing and using banking information from his military supervisor that on at least one occasion was actually witnessed, the purchasing of the goods was witnessed by another military member. The statements regarding those offenses were official because there was an inseparable military nexus, because the military had a demonstrated substantial interest in the investigation and prosecution of the case.
Why did they send it out to the civilian authorities then?
Well, Your Honor, the record is silent on their specific reason for sending it out, but we know that the military did not stop acting just because they redirected him to go to, or immediately following their direction to have it reported to the base. There could be a myriad of reasons. The record doesn't specifically...
What did they continue to do?
Your Honor, they did several things. They issued no contact orders to both the military supervisor as well as to the appellant. They also changed the work schedules so that they would not be in that relationship.
From a criminal justice perspective or a military law perspective, what did they do?
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, they prosecuted this case. They preferred charges.
Well, that was 3 months later. After the civilians gave it up. But in that interim 3 months, what did they do to set in motion any UCMJ investigation, anything like that?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know when these particular actions occurred, but we know what happened because what we saw at the trial was at some point there was some level of an investigation.
But, Counsel, do you understand that there's a temporal aspect to this case, to the issue in this case, right, which is you can't rely on facts that happened that had nothing to do with the statement, right? I mean, the officialness of the statement has to be determined at the point in time that it's made. And you can't rely on stuff that happened afterwards to make it so.
Well, Your Honor, I agree in part on that from the standpoint of when we're looking at whether or not the statement relates to his duties, I agree that the temporal nature of the statement relates to his duties from the standpoint, just kind of going into that aspect, it did relate to his duties because you're talking about the relationship between a supervisor and supervisee. So I agree from that standpoint, Your Honor.
But what are you talking about?
The temporal aspect of the statements, Your Honor, is that...
Right, except whether it's official. You're saying that it's official because there was a relationship between the victim and the accused? That the thing that made the statement as official is because the victim was the supervisor of the accused?
That is a part of the military nexus, Your Honor, absolutely. I think that's a factor that the court should consider and has considered with regards to TFO. They laid out, this court has laid out several factors in determining whether or not it's official.
Well, what precisely at the point in time that the statement was made to the civilian police off base made this official under our case law?
Several factors, Your Honor. First would be the relationship, as I just mentioned, between the military supervisor and the supervisee.
What does that relationship have to do with the statement?
Well, it relates to his duties.
Did the victim order him to make the statement? No, right?
No, Your Honor. He went in there voluntarily.
All right. What's the next factor?
Beyond that time, at the time they were doing that, it appears that the military supervisor was told around that time that he reported to his command. Around that time, he was saying, okay, you're not to have contact with them.
But again, what relationship does that have to the statement?
Well, again, this all relates to his duties, Your Honor. If the statement itself, if we talk about the content of the statement, because
I'm asking you what, at the point in time that the statement was made, what is the nexus between that statement and his official duties?
Ultimately, the nexus between that and the duties, Your Honor, is the fact that under his statement, the content of the statement relates to a prosecutable offense under the UCMJ. The jurisdiction of the UCMJ encompasses the content of his statement.
What's the duty? The duty to refrain from committing an offense?
No, I wouldn't say that it's that broad, Your Honor.
Well, then what is it?
Not to steal banking information and misuse it from the supervisor.
The duty to refrain from stealing banking information.
And then go out and use it. Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And that's prosecutable under the UCMJ, which we know because, in fact, he was prosecuted here in this case.
So any statement made to anyone related to an offense under the UCMJ is an official statement?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that broad. But where I would
okay,
I would
well,
say
where's the logical limit to what you just said?
The logical limit, Your Honor, is it's certainly within the facts of this case where a person is making a statement to a law enforcement investigator under circumstances that are clearly official from the standpoint that the investigator is conducting an investigation in accordance with their duties, and a military member makes a statement that is regarding, the substance of that statement is regarding UCMJ prosecutable offenses. That is an official statement.
But isn't that true under Article 134.3 in almost any circumstance then?
Well, Your Honor, that's going to rely on the particular state statute. I know the defense has cited to the local state statute here, but that doesn't just because there's a state statute that's prosecutable doesn't mean that Article 107 doesn't apply. As this court has repeatedly said,
but the state statute here is crystal clear. Crystal clear. We don't have to decide whether he was standing on which side of Moody Air Force Base line when he made the statement.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So why can't we have a bright line rule that says military members have a duty to speak the truth when talking to law enforcement officials, period, end of conversation?
Your Honor, I think that's an
They can elect the Fifth Amendment, but if they elect to speak, they have a duty to speak the truth.
Your Honor, I think that's an appropriate statement, and frankly, is not one that's that far off from where this court has already ruled in United States versus Jackson.
Are you suggesting that a statement to civilian police, leave aside the intersay aspect, a statement to civilian police regarding an offense cognizable under the code as well as state law, occurring entirely off base, not inter se, not involving another member of the armed forces, is official?
Well, Your Honor, yes, I would argue that it is, for the reason that this court has analogized.
Well, then what isn't official?
Well, certainly one could imagine statements made to private citizens, statements made.
So, but what you're saying is you're arguing for a per se rule that any statement made to civilian police involving anything that's cognizable under the code is official.
Yes, Your Honor. If it's within the jurisdiction of the UCMJ, meaning, or within the armed forces, meaning prosecutable by the UCMJ, then yes, a statement to civilian law enforcement would be a false statement.
False statement. You know, I'm driving 50 miles from base and I get pulled over for being drunk, which is an offense under the code. False statement, no, I didn't have any more than two beers, to the arresting officer, is an official statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, counsel, and I understand that it's not the statute, but the discussion of the statute that talks about official documents and statements or documents and statements made in the line of duty. We should just ignore that. Or are you saying that the duty is to tell the truth? That all military members have a military official duty to tell the truth to officials.
To a civilian law enforcement, certainly, Your Honor, absolutely. Judge Cox, I believe you just mentioned it, there's a Fifth Amendment right that you not have to make a statement, but if they choose to make a statement to a civilian law enforcement official, they need to tell the truth.
Is that military duty established in a general order? Where does one find that military duty?
Well, Your Honor, I would, let me, if I may, sort of hone that in. When we're talking about the substance of crimes, I mean, that's, when we're talking about within the jurisdiction of the UCMJ, that's where my point is, when we're making statements regarding that. So, if I may just put that limit on as well. And that would be consistent with the 18 U.S.C. 1001, and especially with the court's view that that statute should be interpreted more expansively. Now, I know appellate's counsel stood here and said that that should be more narrowly tailored, that interpretation, but I completely disagree, and this court has completely disagreed. That the view and the interpretation of 18 U.S.C. 1001 should be more expansive.
Why can't we go in the other direction and return to the language of the statute and say that only false statements that are a false record, return, regulation, order, or other official document of the same sort, that only those sorts of false statements should be prosecuted under Article 107?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's consistent with the way this court has viewed towards making an more expanded view.
Well, that's what, but I'm asking you, instead of being more expansive, which is what you're asking for, why don't we go back to the language of the statute and make it more narrow? I mean, why wouldn't we want to do that?
Well, there's a few different reasons, Your Honor, and some of which has actually been interpreted or actually articulated by the court. Well, the court has recognized an expansive view is important because of the unparalleled need to maintain morale, good order, and discipline.
Well, I think it's Article 134, which that's its purpose.
Your Honor, there's a variety of different circumstances that I imagine one could come up with where, you know, you could prosecute something over this or something over that. The goal of the state statute, I imagine, that was cited by appellant here was to protect the state agencies. The goal of 18 U.S.C. 1001 was to protect the federal agencies.
Okay, what military interest is there in protecting the state police?
Well, Your Honor, I would say
where there's a state statute intended to protect them.
I would say that the military necessity and interest in protecting the armed forces in general is in protecting the integrity and the public trust of military members. That's the interest that also is implicated by Article 107. So when you have a military member sitting in front of a civilian law enforcement, and a military member is going to go in there and lie about a crime, how does that undermine the military trust and public trust in the military? I think that's an important interest as well.
We've had the opportunity to look at this area several times. And have any of those prior cases, have we ever said that all you need is a statement concerning an offense that's prosecutable under the UCMJ? Have we ever said that that's the only thing you need?
No, Your Honor.
So you're asking for a new rule in this case.
What I'm asking for, Your Honor,
we haven't said it before. I mean, it's got to be new.
Well, what I'm asking for, Your Honor, is a clarification of what this court said in United States versus Jackson. Whereas if you refer the court to the last...
Well, I mean, we've had several cases since Jackson that have been exactly on this area. And while they've talked about cases that are prosecutable under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, there are a number of other qualifiers in those cases. Why should we abandon those at this point?
Well, what I'm asking for, Your Honor, is not necessarily an abandonment, but more, like I mentioned before, just a clarification and putting it towards the facts of this particular case.
No, you're asking for a per se rule.
Yeah, you're asking for a bright line rule. You aren't asking for an abandonment.
I mean, you're asking for a bright line rule that would encompass more statements than it ever has before, which by definition is an expansion.
That's how I would recommend to interpret that. I think if you look at 18 U.S.C. 1001, if it falls within the jurisdiction of the armed forces, meaning the UCMJ prosecutable, if we're going to take an expansive view, then yes. But the court doesn't have to come forth with that broad rule in order to rule for the government in this case. If you look at United States versus Jackson, there was in that case, there was a military investigator taking the statement, but the court held that thus, even if not subject to an independent duty to account, a service member who lies to a law enforcement agent conducting an investigation as part of his duties has violated Article 107.
Now, part of his duties, and it was a military investigator, was it not?
In this particular case, it was a military investigator. But this particular holding doesn't seem to necessarily distinguish between that.
Isn't that sloughing over a pretty big difference? Lying to an OSI agent and lying to a civilian policeman?
No, Your Honor. I think there is...
Oh, it's exactly the same thing?
I think certainly the content of the statement could be...
No,
exactly
that's not
the same.
What I'm talking about. The statement, by definition, is a lie. The question is to whom it's made.
And I agree with you, Your Honor, that... there is a difference there, but I don't think the appropriate difference should be in determining whether or not it's official is the fact that someone carries a different badge. And that's really what we're talking about here. We've got someone carrying a state badge versus a state.
Now, you seem to be saying more than that, but go ahead.
Well, a possible interpretation, a valid interpretation of Jackson would be that does not draw a distinction between the two. If the court doesn't make that determination, certainly this would be an appropriate time to do that. If someone is sitting as a perpetrator of a crime that involves a stealing banking information from a military supervisor, you know, we're talking about this inseparable military nexus as well. It all falls in here. The contents of the statement fall back.
Well, in the safety valve here is the speaker, using the chief judges. The speaker knows that the hearer is relying on that statement in pursuit of an investigation of some sort, an official investigation in Valdosta, which is also an official investigation for the UCMJ. The speaker knows he's relying on it.
That's exactly right.
So you wouldn't, for example, if I was sitting in a bar and an undercover agent from the CID came up and sat down and I lied to him about something, I didn't know he was an official.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
The fact that he was a federal guy wouldn't make any difference, would it?
No, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Do you have to establish that there was a military duty on the speaker's part here? I mean, we went through that scenario. The chief judge gave three different examples. And it seems to me that you're hanging your hat on the fact that there was a military duty on the part of the speaker to tell the truth.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a compelling argument, but it's certainly not the only dispositive issue in the case. As Chief Judge Baker mention before, there's different possibilities, and one of it is this speaker-military nexus. And we have an inseparable nexus in this case. I mean, this entire issue, this entire series of crimes that he committed arose because of his relationship with his military supervisor. That's where it started. Now, granted, they were friends. They had known each other a long time. They met at Pope Air Force Base. They've been co-workers for 8 years. But ultimately, the reason why he was able to commit these crimes...
But again, that's a nexus that developed out of the situation that ultimately the statement came out of, but not about the statement itself.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the two can be separated. The contents of the statement are about these crimes. I mean, that's the reason why he's there in front of the civilian detective. So this whole incident is based on the fact that this military member committed a crime.
So if the military member had done the same thing to a civilian off base and made the same statement, you think it would not be an official statement?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't, for all the reasons that I mentioned before about the duties and those things, but there's certainly less of a military nexus I would have to acknowledge.
Well, what would the military nexus be then, that it was a military member, an offense under the UCMJ?
Well, then we look at the circumstances of, okay, what is the substantial military interest that goes to the military nexus as well? And I think that the military is, despite appellant's references to it, have demonstrated that. By their use of the new contact orders, by changing the schedule.
But isn't the nexus supposed to be to the purpose of the statute, which is to prevent undermining and perversion of official functions?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
But, and you're converting that into anything that involves the military in any way.
Well, I think...
But you have to go back to the purpose of 1001 and the purpose of 1007. Which I believe is to prevent the undermining of a governmental function. And then 1001 is writ large, a federal function, and 1007 either is or is not limited to a military function. But the statement has to undermine that function. It's not just the statement relates in some manner to the military. True or false? I mean, that's sort of a rhetorical question, so you're supposed to say true. But But if that's the premise of the law, when you make the false statement to that civilian policeman, don't you need to either know that that's going to undermine or predictably know that will impact a military function or not? Not just that in some way you could be charged 5 years later or 3 months later or 2 weeks later with some military offense, but that the statement itself is undermining a function.
Well, I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I would assert that a statement made, a false statement, in this circumstance, undermines the good order and discipline of that unit, where now, whether it was submitted to the military authorities immediately or later, as we mentioned earlier, he reasonably could rely on the fact that this could have been sent over.
So in my construct, your link then to the official military function is the undermining of good order and discipline.
Yes,
is that fair to say if I'm analyzing your position?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And we've got a military supervisor, a military member involved, and he's saying, I didn't do this, and now they go back to the same unit.
Yeah. Well, you can certainly make a case that somebody stealing from his supervisor in a unit would have a corrosive effect on good order and discipline in that unit. But you've, in your earlier conversation with me, said you don't need that restriction. Merely making a statement about anything cognizable under the code, regardless of whether it involves anybody, is enough to render it official. Where's the effect on good order and discipline there? Isn't it a lot more attenuated?
Well, it's certainly not as crystal clear as the facts of this.
Well, I'd say it's a lot more attenuated, isn't it?
Your Honor, we could haggle about characterizations of it. I would say the facts of this particular case, it's clear.
I'm not talking about this case. I'm asking because of the answer you gave me earlier. And now you seem to be retreating from the answer you gave me earlier.
You can respond to the questions. Thank you for saying that.
Your Honor, I'm not retreating from the position. I still stand by my arguments as earlier. What I'm also acknowledging is you don't need to make that decision in order to affirm this conviction.
Thank you.
Based on the facts of this case.
Counsel, let me just ask you, in light of your answers to my earlier questions and in response to your recent answers to Chief Judge Baker's question, what in the scenario I asked you earlier, if this had been that he stole from a civilian off base and made the same statement to the civilian police, what function would he be undermining in that case to make this official?
Well, depending upon the particular facts of the case.
I just gave you the facts of the case. It's a civilian off base.
No other military involvement whatsoever. No one knows about it or anything like that. No.
He stole off base.
Well, certainly the prejudice, good order, and discipline would be, I think, in that scenario, attenuated.
Well, I'm asking you, would we be undermining military function in that case? Or does your answer have to be no?
Well, I think if we define military function as building public trust and gaining and maintaining that, then I would say that is a...
I understand, counsel.
All right, time is up. We can do more questions if you would like, or you can sit down.
If there are any more questions from the court, I'm happy to answer.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Helen?
Your Honor, briefly to address the facts brought forward by the government, just to note the no-contact order that was issued to Airman Capel. If you review the joint appendix, page 194, it appears from that it was issued after the statement was made. It appears that it came after his arrest by downtown authorities. So I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention. And with regard to this statement, there's really two ways that it could be official, and that is through the speaker of the statement, that would be Airman Capel. This document could have been official through the speaker, which is Airman Capel, but this had nothing to do with his duties working on the egress systems for the A-10, and in no way was he representing that he represented the DOD or the federal government or the Air Force when he was making this
statement. Is that the sine qua non?
No, Your Honor, but that would make this...
Well, that would make it official.
That would make it official.
But that's surely not the definition, is it?
Well, in most cases, it seems to go by the basis of the hearer of the statement. And the hearer of the statement, the receiver of the document, was the civilian police...
If he's not talking about his job, it's not official?
Not under a strictly... based on the line of duty of the speaker analysis.
Now, so I thought what you were setting up was that there was one way it could be official was if he was talking about his official duties to whoever he was making the statement. Were you going to give another way?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, it's speaker or hearer. And for the speaker theory, it would be about his official duties. Or, as was mentioned earlier, the various articles of war about false paperwork, you know, your orders, your regulations, the things that are actually listed in Article 107. Those are the speaker-driven ways to make a statement official. The other way, which is more the focus of this case, is the nature of the hearer. And in this case, the hearer is a civilian conducting his own investigation. As noted earlier, the record does not show that there was any link between the military and Detective Renfro at the time of his investigation when he elicited this statement from Airman Capel.
Counsel, looking at the case law from this court, if this had been a member's trial, how in the world would a military judge instruct the members on whether or not the statement to the local policeman was official?
That military judge would have to ensure that the members know that this is about a link to the line of duty of either the speaker or the hearer of the statement. The members would have to determine, is there a link to the official duties of Airman Capel?
Within the jurisdiction of the United States, not within the jurisdiction of Valdosta, Georgia. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Is there any particular reason, going back to Chief Judge Baker's question, any particular reason why the United States Air Force doesn't try these cases under Article 134.3? Because clearly the Georgia law makes it a crime to lie to the cops.
Yes, Your Honor. And given the nature of the concern for the government in this case, it would actually be appropriate as basically service discrediting conduct under Article 134. I see my time is up. Any further questions from the court?
Nope. We're happy. Thank you very much. The case is now submitted. The court thanks both counsel, and the court will stand in recess until 5:50. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 9:55.